It is. He picked up a piece of what once was the stone bird. Nothing more than stone. He snapped his fingers and the bird reappeared, whole and animated. Its wings shivered behind its body, and it fixed an irritated gaze on me. The bird was not the innocent thing. It's the feeling, said Amar, dusting his palms. Preservation is an innocent desire, and you let arrogance compromise that. Arrogance? I returned, my cheeks burning. I was showing strength, strength that I could be merciless and thoughtless, returned Amar. He flashed a vulpine grin. Kill, if you must. String a garland of severed heads around your waist if you want. I would take you in my arms if you were drenched in blood or dressed in rubies. But think. Impulsiveness is a dangerous thing. You gave me no choice. I merely gave a command. Use your sword. You were the one who thought there was only one choice. When I asked what you wanted me to do with it, you asked me what swords are for, I finished quietly. He hadn't actually said what to do. Amar picked up the sword from the ground and twirled it against the marble. Swords could also be used for freeing. You could have cut through the chain around the bird's foot and set it free. Swords could be used for killing, but it needn't be the bird. Wouldn't the more merciful choice have been to use the sword against the oppressor?
So run the sword through you?
Why not? Everything is a matter of interpretation, and that is how you will rule, he said, before handing the sword's hilt to me. Think on what you've seen today, but do not let me influence you. Your will is yours alone. I stared at the sword in my hand, still gleaming despite the dark. I can promise you I won't forget. Amar paused, his voice soft. Memory is a riddled thing. I would caution you from making promises you cannot keep. I moved toward the door, but Amar stopped me with a shake of his head. Gupta will arrive in a moment to escort you. He straightened the cuffs of his Sherwani jacket. I myself have a number of duties to attend to, so I must leave. Before I could stop myself, I blurted out, Why? He paused and took a step to me. Darkness, soft-edged and heavy, clung to the room. In the shadows, his smile held all the lazy grace of a cat.
Would you miss me?
Curiosity inspired my question. Nothing more, I said. But even my voice was unconvinced.
Even so, there's no greater temptation than to stay by your side.
The door swung open and a chorus of voices trickled into the room, silvery and indistinct, like whispers released through clenched teeth. Amar lingered for a moment, his lips tight as though he wanted to say something. Then he cupped his palms together and blew into them. When he opened his hands, a bloom of light shaped like an unopened flower bud lifted off his palm and floated into the room. Brightness drenched away the shadows.
I will never leave you in the dark.
And with that, he left. I waited for the door to shut before I sank against the throne. I buried my face in my hands, squeezing my eyes shut. When Amar promised me the power of 100 kings, this wasn't what I had in mind. It felt wrong. My duty was to tweak people's fortunes like they were designs gone awry, instead of lives filled with dreams, quirks, and ambitions. A knock at the door pulled me out of my thoughts.
Are you ready to change for dinner? Asked Gupta.
I frowned, turning to the windows of the throne room. When I had stepped inside, I was sure it had been broad daylight. Now wispy clouds like ghost skins streaked a crimson sky. Yes, I called back, still trying to work out the time I had lost. Gupta said nothing as he led me from the throne room back to the bedroom, but there was nothing stiff or awkward in his silence. He was grinning to himself, and every now and then when he caught my eye, he beamed.
I will wait for you out here.
There's no need. I remember my way back to the dining room. Gupta shook his head.
I insist.
If you insist, I said stiffly, annoyance prickling inside. I entered the room and immediately noticed a new sari folded delicately on the bed. Yards of dove-gray silk strewn with pearls. I dressed quickly before meeting Gupta outside and we walked through the halls. The mirror portals paneling the walls glittered strange reflections. Lush hills carpeted in small blue flowers. A forest tangled with lights and a bone-white temple balanced between the tips of a craggy mountainside flashed past me. But something else caught my eye. Tucked away in a corner of the hall that I hadn't seen before. A door. Charred at the edges. Lengths of iron, wrapping it round and round. Something about the door twisted my heart. A voice, a mere scratch in the silence, began to sing. I've never tasted dreams so sweet. Such pearly flesh and tender meat. Oh, queen, if you only knew, you'd gladly rip your heart in two. I stopped.
Gupta, what door is that?
He frowned.
Door? What door?
He turned around and then asked sharply.
What did it look like?
I hesitated. Mother Dina's words echoed. Keep some secrets for yourself. The words caught in my throat. This secret, just this one, I would keep to myself until I understood it. I had barely been in Akharan for a day. I couldn't let my guard down entirely. And that voice, it felt like it had been sung to me alone. I can't remember, I lied. Gupta shrugged. As we walked, I kept turning around, half expecting a door strung with chains to glitter just out of sight, but it never appeared. The dining room had changed since yesterday. Today its rug showed a herd of elephants moving through the jungle, and instead of golden platters piled high with food and saffron cushions placed around the table, there were silver platters and mother-of-pearl cushions. Akharan's riches lay unfurled at my feet. But even with all that wonder, I sensed a chill in the room. I pulled my sari closer. There was something else here. I could feel it like breath against my neck. Amar was nowhere in sight. Instead, Gupta pulled out a chair for me.
Please, have a seat, he said. Amar won't be able to dine with you this evening.
Oh, a twinge of disappointment ran through me.
Why not?
He had to attend to an urgent matter of retrieval.
Retrieval of what?
Gupta stiffened and his voice came out in a wheeze. When he caught his breath, he merely pointed to the night sky, where the moon was a ghostly crescent.
Right, I said, deflating a little.
I kept forgetting the rules of the other world. Not a word could be spoken about Akharan's secrets until the new moon. I glared at the moon. Gupta shook his head apologetically and pointed at the food.
Please, eat.
As I ate, I watched Gupta from the corner of my eye. He was writing furiously, quill rapping against the wood as he filled the page with line after line of ink.
What are you doing?
He looked up, quill half suspended in the air before he tapped the scroll.
Record keeping.
Nothing is certain until the ink dries.
What's not certain?
Life, said Gupta matter-of-factly.
The half-eaten platters of food stared back at me glumly. I was, against all experience, strangely without an appetite.
When you finish, you have the evening to yourself, said Gupta, scrutinizing the scrolls before him. I would be happy to show you my collection of record-keeping on the distribution of leaves per branch. It's one of my more noteworthy accomplishments.
I glanced down the halls. Again, that voice from the charred door rustled against me. The air prickled with invisible heat and magic. Gupta continued talking, but his voice ebbed in and out, splashing against a rhyme I couldn't catch, no matter how hard I strained.
Oh, the treacherous moon, dear queen, please.
Did I ever tell you about the time I interviewed a mollusk? Fascinating.
Free me. Find me, hidden in the tree, if you...
Hungry more often than not, which is... My pulse slowed. A sharp pain turned the colors bright and sickening. I couldn't even feel the rugs beneath my feet. My toes felt like they were sinking into damp, gritty sand. Water lapping at my ankles. A name crouched in my throat. A name I should have been screaming, but couldn't recall. The voice from the charred door was a plea, and all I knew was that I had to leave this room. I had to find the door. I stood up, knocking my chair over behind me. Whatever spell of pain had clung to me broke instantly. I looked down and saw the silk rug. Gupta stared, a little confused. I needed to get out. I needed to distract him.
"Why don't we play a game of riddles?" I said suddenly. "I'll stand outside and let you think. When you're ready, call my name. Yes?"
Gupta sat up straighter, his head tilting bird-like to one side.
"What riddle?" "I'll give you three. You seem like you'd be very good at them."
Gupta beamed.
"I have been known..."
"Excellent," I said quickly.
"I am a nightmare to most, and a dream for the broken. Who am I?"
"Next riddle. I am your future. Who am I?" Gupta silently repeated them.
"And the last?"
"I hide the stars, but am frightened by the sun. I am not the night. Who am I?"
"Delightful," said Gupta, clapping his hands. "You'll stay outside?"
I smiled. "Of course." He gave a distracted nod and I slipped out of the dining room. Curiosity, sharp as frissons of heat, ran up my spine. I tried calling out to the voice, but there was nothing. Alone, I was beginning to think it was nothing more than the palace's quirks. Both Amar and Gupta had said the palace would test me. Perhaps this was nothing more. I looked around. The great corridors of Akarn unfurled before me like a stone maze, and I took off down one of the paths, fingers trailing along the walls and murals. Moonlight flooded the palace, wiping away its solemnity and filling it with a cold, twinkling beauty. Gupta had been right yesterday. I did mind the silence. It felt too controlled. When he spoke of the palace, he made it sound like it was a sentient being, something that could hop and shuffle, talk back and frown. I hadn't believed him, but I was beginning to. Everything about the palace felt deliberate. Some of the mirrors around me were lit up with life. A few of the cities inside them were deep in sleep, with a slim moon keeping vigil over their slumber. And then there were the mirrors with darker scenes. Wars and flags of countries I didn't recognize. A burning smell, as if it could stretch through the silvery portals and spill into Akarn. I never saw anyone in these reflections. The portals were like a bird's-eye view looking down. But I still saw the fires. I still saw the horses pounding the ground beneath them, moving out of sight, far beyond the edges of the mirrors. Up ahead, the white marble floors of the palace had given way to shiny lacquered wood. I walked forward, sure that I could hear Gupta's voice if he called. Unlike the bare stone walls of the throne room or main hallways, these walls were giant mirrors, darkened with time, and peeling to reveal the silver beneath them. Beneath the shadow of a large arch, something glittered. I stared into the darkness, but saw nothing but a pale wooden door cracked open. The stone was cool beneath my feet, and tendrils of light snaked past me, pooling into silver puddles before bringing the room into full view. My eyes widened. Before me was a twinkling garden, but instead of potted plants and wilting flowers, every piece of this garden was bright and translucent, like it had been carved from glass. I leaned forward. It was carved of glass. From the stately banyan tree with its ropey leaves, to the ashwagandha shrub and its bright red fruit, everything was glass and crystal. I walked in a daze through the labyrinth of crystal plants and lightly touched the cool stems. I stroked the glassy tendrils of an umla plant and laughed as emerald vines glittered and brushed against my skin.
But not even the crystal plants were as lovely as the soft blooms of light, winking and disappearing into the translucent vines and petals. Thousands of lights blinked in and out, whooshing and whirling around the plants, so that everything seemed wrought of light and glass. It was beautiful. I turned around, taking in the full view of the garden. Moonlight had teased away the shadows, and my world had become dream-soft and slicked in glass. For the first time since coming to Akharin, I felt at peace.
"What are you doing here?" thundered a voice behind me.
I nearly jumped. Even without turning, I knew who the voice belonged to. Amar. Chapter 12. The Garden of Glass. I raised my chin and stared back at him. I had no reason to feel embarrassed. After all, he was the one who said Akharin was just as much mine as it was his. The door had been open. And yet, a flush still crept up the back of my neck.
"I was taking a walk," I said weakly.
"Where's Gupta?"
"The dining room," I said before adding defensively. "I only walked a little down the halls."
His jaw tightened. "I told you that the kingdom's location makes it dangerous."
"Gupta told me that any place that might hold danger would be locked up," I retorted. "The door to this room was not locked."
"Even so," said Amar, "they might sing through their bindings. It's better to have an escort."
As you can see, I am unscathed from my walk from one hall to the next.
"Today," cut in Amar tightly, "today you are unscathed. Tomorrow is unknown, as is the next day and the day after that. Never make light of your life."
"I never do." The vial of mandrake poison flashed in my mind. Life led me here, life and the desire to live it.
Gupta burst into the room.
"Oh, good," he breathed, hands pushing against his knees. He looked like he'd just run from one side of a country to the next. Guilt heated my face. He turned to Amar.
"I apologize. I lost track with the riddles."
"You can leave, my friend," said Amar. "She is safe with me."
Gupta looked between us, started to say something, and thought better of it. There was a touch of pity in his expression as he looked at the winking lights around us. With one last glance at the garden, Gupta left. Amar loosed a breath.
"I understand, you know."
I looked up.
"The forced silence. The voices of this palace."
We stood there, not saying anything. I felt too aware of the space between us. Even with Akharin's secrets spiraling in the shadows of my head, I couldn't ignore the weightless feeling that had gripped me. Standing beside Amar did something to me, like my center had shifted to make room for him.
"You do not trust me, do you?"
"No," I said. I had no reason to lie. "I told you in the night bazaar that trust is won in actions and time, not words."
"I wish you trusted me."
"I don't place my faith in wishes," I said. "How can I? I can't even..." I bit back the rest of my words. "I can't even see your face." Perhaps Gupta was lying, and he really did have a disfiguring scar. Amar moved closer, until we were only a hand space apart.
"What?"
he coaxed, his voice hovering between a growl and a question. "I can't even see your face." A strange chill still curled off of him, like smoke, and even though the glass garden was teeming with little lights, shades veiled him.
"Is that what you want?" he said. "Would it make you trust me?"
"It would be a start. You are impossible to please." I said nothing. Amar leaned forward, and I felt the silken trails of his hood brush across my neck. My breath constricted.
"Is that what you want?"
"An unguarded gaze can spill a thousand secrets."
"I would know them anyway," I said evenly.
I waited for him to dissuade me, but when he remained silent, I reached out. Amar stood still, lean muscles tensed beneath his clothes.
I could hear his breathing, see his chest rising and falling, smell that particular scent of mint and smoke that hung around him. Slowly I untied the ends of the dove-gray hood. Small pearls snagged against the silk of his covering. Suddenly, his hands reached around my wrist.
"I trust you," he said.
The hood fell to the ground, a mere rustle of silk against glass. I lifted my gaze, searching Amar's face. He was young, and yet there was something worn about his features. I took in the stern line of his nose and the smooth expanse of tawny skin. His features possessed a lethal kind of elegance, like a predator at rest, bronzed jaw tapering to a knife's point, lips curled in the faintest of grins, and heavy brows casting dusky shadows over his eyes. When I looked at him, something stirred inside me. It felt like recognition sifted through dreams, like the moment before waking, when sleep blurred the true world. When beasts with sharp teeth and beautiful winged things flew along the edges of your mind. Amar met my gaze and his eyes were raw, burning.
"Well?"
he asked. There was no rebuke in his voice, only curiosity.
"I see no secrets in your gaze," I said.
"I see only night and smoke, dreams and glass, embers and wings, and I would not have you any other way."
"You have made your request. What about mine?"
"I am not the one withholding secrets." He smiled, and I stared at him for a moment. When he smiled, his severe face softened into something beautiful. I wanted to see it again.
"On the contrary, I am the one who has no choice. You, on the other hand, do."
"What do you want from me?" He reached out, fingers sliding across the length of my hair.
"Some strands of your hair."
Some of the courtiers in Bharata used to tie their wives' hair around their wrists when they traveled. It was a sign of love and faith, to remain connected to the person you love, even if it was just by a circlet of hair.
"May I?" asked Amar.
I nodded. With a small knife, Amar deftly clipped a number of strands. Quickly, he twirled them into a bracelet and slipped it onto his wrist. There was another bracelet on his hand that I had not noticed until now. A simple strap of black leather tied into an elegant knot.
"Thank you for this," he said, pulling his sleeve over the other strap.
"It's nothing," I said, trying for lightness.
"And yet I would trade everything for it," he said.
There was no tease in his voice, nothing but a strange straightforwardness, like he'd never said anything more honest in his entire life.
"Then you must be relieved I gave it willingly."
"Astounded," he murmured, still tracing the circlet. He looked at me, and something light fluttered in my stomach.
"Not relieved. Relief is when you want something to stop."
A small light floated between us, only to vanish in an instant.
"What are those?"
Amar followed my gaze.
"Wishes."
My eyes widened.
"They grant wishes?"
"Sadly, no. They're wishes already made."
"Of what?"
"Or who?" countered Amar.
"Is this another secret the moon keeps from me?"
"No," said Amar with a grin. "It is a secret that I choose to keep from you."
"Why won't you tell me?"
"Because then this would lose all its fun."
I rolled my eyes and turned away from him when he caught me around the wrist.
"Don't you want to know what I wished for?"
he said, his breath against my neck.
"No,"
I said, but my gaze was fixed on all the blinking lights. There were so many. And why did he say "or who" when it came to his wishes?
"I can't stand deception."
"Then stop flattering yourself."
He laughed and released me.
"I'll tell you what I wished for, if you give me a kiss."
I turned to face him.
"Even if I did, you might lie. There's no way to prove that you wished for what you said you did."
He smiled.
"Clever as ever."
"Or unwilling to kiss you."
"Another lie," he said, grinning. Amar reached into the air, and a handful of lights danced on his palms.
Kiss me, and you'll know I'm telling the truth.
He leaned forward, the small lights illuminating his face. In the light, he looked honey-drenched. But I wasn't going to give him a victory so easily. I quickly pecked his cheek and stepped back. Amar was still tipped toward me, his eyes a little wide before he started laughing.
Foolish optimism.
I ignored him.
And those wishes?
See for yourself, he said, opening his palm. There was nothing in his hands. Around us, a third of the lights had disappeared. I stared into the dark, waiting for them to flare into being, but they were gone.
Once a wish comes true, it disappears for good.
That's what you wished for? I asked, incredulous. A peck on the cheek?
No.
Then what?
This, said Amar, gesturing to the space between us. The chance to be this close to you. We looked at one another in silence. There was something new between us, fragile and thrumming. I didn't know what to do. Nothing I had learned in Bharata's sanctum had taught me this. Nothing I had seen in the harem came close to what I felt. There was an undercurrent of depth, of something hard-won and dangerous. I couldn't treat it with lightness, and I didn't want to.
Maya, he started, when another voice cut him off.
Gupta stood in the arch of the doorway, his face twisted in apology.
I tried to contain it as much as I could.
Amar stepped away from me, his face stony.
I'll be there in a moment. Take her back to the room.
Something cold thudded in my stomach, a reminder to rein in how I felt and keep him at a distance.
I'm sorry, said Amar,
but he wouldn't look me in the eye, and before I had a chance to speak, he had left. That night, I tried to enter a peaceful dream of nothingness, but I kept waking. Each lapse of restful sleep slipped into a gray and distorted vision of the glass garden. In my dream, a monster wearing 5 blurred faces turned to me.
Did you notice nothing strange about your garden?
Separate voices sprang from the mouths. Panic turned my skin cold. I could think of a number of strange things, not the least of which was the animated split personality accosting my dreams, but I kept my mouth shut. The creature leered its split face at me.
There's not a living thing in this court, is there?
Chapter 13. A Room Full of Stars. I woke with a start. The nightmare's words burned in my mind like a flame. Not a single flower or tree filled Akaran's marble halls. Even its garden was glass. I thought of what I had seen of the night bazaar. It was magical, undeniably beautiful, but it was also dangerous, coaxing. The star-bright loam where jewel fruit swung beneath silver trees hadn't been the only thing I saw. Something else had moved in that sticky darkness. Flurried sounds of movements quickened outside, and I closed my eyes, feigning sleep. The bed sank as Amar sat beside me. Warm fingertips trailed across my cheek, brushing the hair from my forehead and sending sparks of light up my spine. His lips grazed my temples.
Soon, Johnny.
I waited until his footsteps echoed outside before squinting around the room. Without him, it seemed colder. I retraced his touch lightly, careful to avoid smudging the imprint of his lips against my skin. He had called me Johnny. My life. I stared at the closed door, where his skin touched mine felt burnished, hollowed by the words he left hanging in the air. Johnny, Johnny, Johnny. I wanted him to say it again. I wanted him to say it closer to my ear, my neck, my lips. But the surge of warmth faded as the memory of my dream prickled behind my eyes. Magic was not the only coaxing, dangerous thing around me. Like yesterday, when I returned after washing up, the bed had been made, and a new sari was waiting for me. This time, it was a rich amber, studded with topaz stones and small mirrors, so that when I wrapped it around me, the colors shimmered
as if they had borrowed some of their brilliance from the sun. A similar set of matching jewels lay in piles on the bed. Something about wearing a necklace other than my mother's felt wrong. Inevitably, my thoughts turned to Gowri. Who was telling her stories in the dark? When I stepped outside my room, Gupta was already standing there. The air felt tense, as if someone had smothered the palace into silence so that it could watch and wait. I paused outside the door. I thought I heard something. A voice? My name? Shaking my head, I walked down the familiar hall toward the dining room, but my glance kept darting from the walls and doors, ignoring the beautiful sights flashing in the mirrors. What had happened to that door from before? Around me, muddled voices filled the palace. Sometimes the voices were incoherent, but today I heard a sound sonorous and riven as an ancient stream. You can have him, but not hold him. He gives you gold, but your bed is cold. You've seen his eyes, but not his spies. Who is he? Amar, I breathed. Gupta looked up. Did you say something? The riddle you asked, I said, a little dazed.
I didn't say anything.
A chill shot through me. There was no one in the hall but us. I said nothing and walked quickly down the halls, trying to shake the doubt and fear that kept creeping up my arms. When we got to the dining room, it was decorated in a sun-drenched yellow. Carven statues of minor birds with ruffs of silk around their stone necks dotted the room. Outside, there was no flash of the sun, no hint of clouds. Gupta pulled out a chair for me.
I figured out your riddles from yesterday.
I looked at him, my mind still twisting around the words I heard in the hallway. And?
Your first one was, I am a nightmare to most, and a dream for the broken. Who am I? And the answer to that is death.
Correct.
Your second riddle was, I am your future. Who am I?
And?
The answer to that is ash.
Again, correct. And the last?
I hide the stars, but I'm frightened by the sun. I am not the night. Who am I?
The answer is darkness. I smiled. All three are correct. He stared at me. There were dark circles beneath his eyes. He looked aged in the space of a day.
You ran off last night.
I got lost.
You're smarter than that, and so am I, said Gupta.
I looked away from him, feeling the slightest twinge of guilt.
If I were you, I'd remember the answers to those riddles when you're walking around the palace.
You yourself said that you held the key to anything dangerous.
Even so, he said, mirroring Amar's response.
I tried to think of something to say, but Gupta had turned from me, and the tight, closed-off expression on his face said that I shouldn't even bother trying to push the subject.
You seem quite absorbed in your work, I said, trying to change the topic as he bent his head toward the endless scrolls.
If only I wasn't, said Gupta.
Can I help?
He smiled, but it was a weary thing.
The fact that you are even here is help enough.
But I wasn't doing anything. I was wearing clothes set out for me on a bed, wandering allotted spaces of a hall, feeling around for questions they could answer. I was in a limbo of waiting.
How did you sleep? Asked Gupta, his gaze once more fixed on the parchment.
I thought of the nightmare and masked a shudder.
Well enough, I lied.
After breakfast, Amar stood waiting for me in the center of a marble vestibule. Around him, the mirror portals flashed through the settings. A fox, napping in tall grass. A shining cave strung with ghost-lit threads, and a cliff jutting a stony chin to the sea. Amar grinned, and once more I was transfixed by the way a small smile could soften the stern angles of his jaw, and the haunted look in his eyes.
Are we going to the tapestry room?
He shook his head.
Not yet. Those decisions take time. There are other things to see and know here.
I shivered at the thought of yanking the threads. I was in no rush to condemn someone. Amar stepped toward a door I hadn't noticed until now, inky black and studded with pearls and moonstone. He pushed it open, and a chilly gust kissed my face.
"I promised you the moon for your throne, and stars to wear in your hair," said Amar, gesturing inside.
"And I always keep my promises." Infinite. That's how it felt to stand there in a realm, a field, a marvel of stars. Cold light spangled the space around us. Darkness so old that the shadows felt like relics twisted between the lights. The air was scentless, laced with frost. We stood on nothing but air, and yet it was solid. In the half-light, Amar's face glittered, and starlight clung to his hair. I stared around me, my heart skidding. The things I had called bright and blind enemies shimmered all around me. How many times had I cursed them? And now, I was in their world. Amar reached for my hand and put something in my palm. I looked down. String.
"For conquering," he said.
I stretched the string into a taut line.
"Conquering what? Insects?"
"No, your enemies." "The stars. Fate." The string drooped in my fingers.
"Why do you hate them?" he asked.
"If Akarin has its eyes and ears in Bharata, then you already know," I said darkly, thinking of the horoscope that had shadowed the past 17 years.
"Do you believe the horoscope?"
"No." I meant it. There was no proof. Sometimes I still thought it was a hateful rumor born of Mother Dina's jealousy.
"Then why hate the stars?"
"For what they did. Or I guess, what they made other people do," I said softly.
"For making me hated without reason, and without evidence. Wouldn't you hate distant jailers?"
"I don't believe they're jailers. I believe the stars."
"Then you're a fool to marry me."
He laughed.
"I believe them, but I choose to read them differently. I don't see any happy way to explain death and destruction."
"Doesn't death make room for life?
Autumn trees die to make room for new shoots, and destruction is part of that cycle. After all, a devastating forest fire lets the ground start anew."
I stared at him. No one had ever said anything like that in Bharata. No one had ever challenged the stars. And yet, the light contoured him, clung to him, like the stars knew and believed everything he said. Maybe I believed him, too. All I had done was curse the stars from a distance. I'd never thought to reinterpret what they meant. I turned around, as if seeing the night sky for the first time. Gently, Amar placed the string back in my hand. He pointed at 3 stars. One on my right, one in front, and one on my left.
"Bind them. Conquer them."
The stars were on completely different sides of the room. One, with blue edges, dangled above me. The other had a core of fire. And the last was nothing more than tendrils of bright smoke.
"They're too far apart," I said, holding up the small piece of string.
"That's impossible."
"Then make it possible. Reinterpret them. The room will answer."
"It's not even a room," I started, gesturing across the vast expanse of sky, and then I stopped. It wasn't a room. Yet. As if answering my thoughts, the space around us shrank, dragging the stars together so that their celestial glimmer was lost, and they looked like little more than shining cuts. Light still seeped out, but the room felt brighter. The 3 stars were closer, but still not close enough to tie with a foot of string. I reached out, my thoughts whirring. Reinterpret them. I used to think of the stars as cruel and fixed ornaments. But what about the sky that held them aloft? Could I touch it? Push past it? My fingers grazed the night, cool and sweet-smelling, perfumed with the scent of vespertine flowers that only opened their blossoms to the moon. And then I stepped forward. I gasped. I could move in the night gaps, like they were hallways themselves. Quickly I slid into the rifts between stars. I imagined the space as a sphere, bedizened with little astral ornaments, and soon those heavy celestial bodies became small as candies held in one's palm. The thread easily looped them together. I grinned, turning to Amar. Between us was a sphere thick with stars, and around us twined soft shadows like cats weaving between ankles.
Magnificent, he said.
His gaze was full of awe, but I saw something else in his eyes. Longing. Then he reached into the sphere, drawing out the string with the three stars. He twisted them between his hands, fashioning a constellation no larger than a sparrow. Amar stepped forward, sliding the stars above my ear. It cast a glow that turned his face silvery and beautiful.
There, my queen, he said, a constellation to wear in your hair.
We spent the rest of the day lost in that room of old planets and forgotten meteors. I stepped across flattened comets and spilled halos of things that may have burned for centuries or may have always been illusions. It didn't matter. For the first time, I felt like I was seeing things differently. Amar kept testing my perspective. He clasped nebulas in my hands and told me to think of them as fate. Being with him was like seeing for the first time. I even started to think differently about the horoscope. Could I see a glimmer of silver in all that darkness? I wanted to, and now I almost did. When we had closed the door to the star room, Amar reached up to brush his fingers against the constellation in my hair.
It suits you, he said.
Warmth crept to my cheeks. For a long moment we stood in that alcove. The mirror portals faintly shimmered. In the distance I could see the lines of cities and flush of daybreaks, but everything felt dim compared to the space between us. It felt so charged it could have been alive. Amar moved closer to me, but a sudden howl across the palace sprang us apart. Amar's eyes snapped to a distant hall, and his mouth, just a moment ago curved in a smile, was now a tight cut.
Come, Maya, it's not safe for you to be out here.
Why? I said, following his gaze. Were my eyes fooling me, or did the shadow of a beast just cross the vestibule? Something dank overwhelmed my senses. Wet fur. Salt-crusted claws. That sound of the howling slid under my skin, conjuring something horrifying and nameless in my mind. Faceless bodies falling to the floor, the frantic spurt of blood leaving a vein. Amar half-pulled, half-ran me to the dining room. Inside, the room was lit up, and lanterns of cut topaz hung suspended from the ceiling. Gupta ran to meet me, his gaze shadowed, as he and Amar exchanged some silent conversation.
I am sorry, Amar said quickly, before running out of the room.
I stood there, unable to shake off the sound of the hounds. Gupta flashed a mournful expression.
What was that?
Gupta started before shaking his head, his face pained.
I cannot say, I am sorry.
My hands clenched into fists.
The moon?
He nodded.
Were those hunting hounds in the palace?
Gupta paused and nodded. My skin crawled.
What were they hunting?
You know, I cannot answer that. I sat stiffly in my chair, sparing a single glance to the taunting half-moon outside. There was still time before Akharin would make itself fully known to me. Until then, I had to endure. I tried to pretend that the sound was a warning, that there was a reasonable explanation behind it. But I couldn't forget the horrible, stomach-churning feeling it rent through me. And when I bent my head to eat, the constellation of stars fell onto my lap. Dull and silver, but sharp as teeth. Chapter 14. The Lion in the Pillar. For 3 days I did not see Amar. The only sign of him was the sleep-mussed side of the bed. Always it was cold to the touch. I wandered the halls alone, exploring the doors of Akharin that would open to me. Many of them were bolted shut, but some were not. One door in particular kept flickering to my mind, the charred one, with chains wrapped around it. but I never saw it, despite looking. On the first day, I found a room where snowdrifts floated upside down in soft, swirling eddies. Once the snow had piled onto the ceiling, it fell in ribbons of translucent silk before sinking into the floor, for the snow-silk cycle to start anew. On the second day, I found a sweltering hot room behind a door that bore a shifting pattern of sand dunes. Inside, sinuous shadows danced across the floor. Curious, I reached down to touch the pattern, and the dark puddled into my hands, wet as ink. On the third day, I found a door carved with feathers. Carven niches filled with eggs covered the walls. Behind the shelves of eggs, someone had painted beautiful renderings of rain quails and white-eared pheasants, jungle fowl, and storm petrels, ibis and osprey. When I stepped inside, the painted birds cocked their heads, chirruping and crooning to themselves. The eggs became seamed with light, and soft birdsong filled the air. On the fourth day, I found a pale white courtyard with a single huge pillar in the middle. The ceiling above was a soft twilight, burnt copper edging a smoky blue. It was a strange place. The air smelled damp and furious. I ran my fingers across the pillar before snatching my hand back. A crack had split the pillar. The hairs on the back of my neck rose. A hideous roar growled from within the pillar, and I jumped back. "It's only an illusion," came a voice near the door. I spun around to see Amar slouched against the doorway. He looked gaunt. Shadows creased the skin under his eyes, and his hair was mussed. Still, he smiled to see me, and I couldn't help but smile back. Until now, I didn't realize that the listlessness I had felt was because of him. I had missed his presence, his speech. Next to him, I felt more alive. "What is this?" I asked, gesturing to the growling pillar. Amar sank into an onyx chair that he had conjured from thin air. He tilted his head back and took a deep breath. "Are you well?" "Soon enough." His smile didn't meet his eyes. "That," he said, "is a reminder that none can escape death. I am fond of the legend." The moment he said that, I knew exactly who was in the pillar, and with a strange ache, I remembered the harem of Bharata. "Narasimha," I breathed. "I have always liked that tale." His eyes widened in surprise. "You are familiar with it?" I nodded. It was the one tale I never told Gauri. Too gory, but for some reason, strangely comforting to me. The pillar quivered behind us, as if it was waiting for me to tell the tale myself. Amar leaned forward, his broad shoulders hunched around him like a predator in wait.
"Tell it to me."
"Why? We both know the tale."
"Even so, I want to hear it from your lips. Tell the tale. The room will keep rhythm."
"Tell the tale." My heart clenched. "I miss you, Gauri." Sinking into my old habit was easy enough. I sat on the floor, crossing my legs in front of me, my gaze flickering between Amar and the pillar. Amar's eyes were closed, his head tilted back to expose his bronzed throat. I spun my tail, and the sky shimmered with images. I told Amar of the demon king who wished to escape death, so he performed the most severe penances until he was granted a boon by the gods. He prayed that he would not die inside or outside his home. He prayed that he would die neither at night or day, nor in the ground or in the sky. He prayed that neither man nor beast could kill him. He prayed no weapon could harm him. Amar's head snapped up. He looked at the pillar with a wicked smile.
"And yet death found its way to him."
I nodded. "One day the god appeared as part man, part lion, and burst forth from the pillar. A being of shadow tore through the pillar. A lion's mane cast a torn shadow across the marble. Fangs lengthened in its mouth. He came upon the demon king at twilight."
"Which is neither night nor day," said Amar.
"And he appeared on the threshold of a courtyard.
neither indoors nor out.
And he spread the king across his lap,
neither above nor below ground.
The shadow story played out in front of us. A tusked, hulking man dragged to his knees and then lifted onto the thighs of the beast god. And he used his fingernails, not a true weapon. The shadow being lifted muscled arms above his head, and claws erupted from his fingers. Amar grinned.
And then death took him, I said.
Yes, finished Amar. He did. The shadow beast tore its claws into the demon king. Blood spattered across the walls. Within seconds, the images collapsed, and the beast god slunk back into the pillar. One eye slit to the outside world, before the marble folded up and swallowed him. I stood up, my hands shaking for no reason.
Beautiful, said Amar.
I found it gruesome, I said, shivering. Amar rose and walked to where I stood.
I was not talking about the story.
Oh.
Why do you like such a gruesome tale?
In Bharata, we were taught that it was a tale of the god's might. But I saw another story within it, the play of interpretation that turned something terrifying and ironclad into something that could be conquered. I was reminded of the star room where Amar had taken me only days ago. The story was like a different way of seeing.
It gave me hope that maybe there was some way around the horoscope. It was a lesson in language, too, almost like a riddle.
Amar stared at me and then he laughed.
Only my queen would find hope in horror.
He took my hand in his, and his gaze was burning.
You are my hope, and more.
What does that make you?
My horror?
And more, he said. All I saw were his eyes, velvet dark, the kind of umbra that shadows envy. Amar stared at me, and his gaze was desperate with hope, reckless. I should have stopped. I should have stepped away, but I didn't. I leaned forward, and a soft growl like surrender escaped his throat. He dug his fingers into my back and pulled me into a kiss. Amar's kiss was furious. No heat, just lightning. Or maybe that was what his touch teased out of me. Vivid streaks of light, dusk, and all her violent glory. I was lost. I leaned into his kiss, and the world around us peeled into nothing. I felt like I could stand over chasms empty of time, and this moment, like a chain of soft blooming stars, would still be ours. We kissed until we couldn't breathe, and then we kissed until we needed the touch of one another like breath itself. I never glanced at the moon for the next week. I knew, buried beneath my happiness, that it was temporary, and that sooner or later I would have to pull Vikram's thread, but I ignored it. I was too lost in the magic of Akaran and Amar. Akaran had no seasons, so we spent our days trying to find them. Amar led me to a summer hall, where the sky was dim and lovely, bleached of its blue by the heat. Squalls gusted in the corners, and above us hung lush glass vines where crystal mangoes swayed. In the monsoon room, we fashioned small enamel elephants and sent them trumpeting across the liquid, stormy floors. Amar blew on them, and small coronets of clouds hovered above their heads. In the summer hall's heat, I told him stories, and in the ruthless rainstorms of the monsoon room, he kissed me. Beside him, the world was a soft, pulsing, and bright thing, alive with hidden angles that we could uncover one by one. It was more than magic. It was life turned relentless and astral, and I reveled in it. But even in this happiness, my bed was always cold. He would leave before dinner and return while I slept. Sometimes his face was more gaunt than lovely, but he smiled anyway each time that he saw me. Sometimes at night I heard the echo of hounds baying and my skin would crawl, but I would forget it, choosing bliss over burden. Sometimes I looked behind me, certain I had seen a glimpse of that charred door wrapped in chains. But it always danced out of sight. And then one night, Amar appeared for dinner. He sat across from Gupta, not meeting my gaze. Outside, the moon waned to a pairing.
Just 2 more days. Tomorrow, you must make your decision, said Amar quietly. He left abruptly after that, hardly touching his food, hardly saying a word. Worry bit at me. What if I made the wrong choice? When I walked back to the room, I heard a soft song calling out to me for the first time in days.
You are running out of moon time. Listen to my warning rhyme. I know you hear me in your head. I know the monster in your bed.
I shook off the voice and shut the bedroom door behind me. I felt like insects made of ice had crawled under my skin. The palace was filled with riddling voices. It was nothing. It meant nothing. Maybe tomorrow I would find a room playing out a skit where one character said those words to another. My heart calmed, but my mind wasn't convinced. That night, I dreamed of locked doors and baying hounds. Rooms that were night dark, and a beast king that smiled and laughed around a mouthful of broken stars to sing one phrase over and over. I know the monster in your bed. Chapter 15. Veins of Magic. I stood before the tapestry. Sweat stamped my palms. Even now, the threads dazzled, shifting, coiling, breathing, pulsing. Impossible to tame, like the sea in a storm. Amar faced me. He looked haunted. His hair was mussed, and when he finally turned to look at me, it was with a mix of hope and fear. What have you decided? I tried to think about a decision, but each time I was struck by the memory of the helmets piling up in my father's inner sanctum. I forced myself to look at the tapestry. I already knew what it would show me. The bodies of my father's people being dragged through a foreign empire that would herald peace, but at a deadly cost. A future of fragile peace won more quickly, with less bloodshed, but with no memory of Bharata's great legacy. Worse, its people would lose all their sovereignty and identity. Some might even be forced into slavery, but all would be forced to obey a new ruler.
Why do we need to make this decision now?
Amar's hands tightened, but he relaxed them almost immediately. He was quiet for a moment, and I colored from his silence.
The longer you wait, the more the threads unravel, he said. See?
Amar was right. Several of the glittering threads had begun to fray. My fingers hovered over them. The white one gleamed with Vikram's potential as a leader. The red one shone with Vikram's potential as a warrior. Both threads held the promise of peace, and both came with a different cost. And yet with either path, it seemed like Bharata would pay the price. Amar circled me, his hands clasped behind his back.
You have to make this decision.
I could feel his gaze on me, sharp, unrelenting, and also desperate.
We must choose the thread that affords the best outcome for the most people, thus maintaining a balance of peace, he said. You see, though, how it draws on so many different aspects. It is not just one person. They are all interconnected.
I stared up at him. For a moment his eyes searched mine, and in the depths of his gaze I felt a swell of sorrow. He turned sharply from me, and I forced myself to summon the most diplomatic tone I could.
The red thread carries too much risk, I said.
The peace was accomplished more easily, but who's to say that the peace will hold long after Vikram dies? The risk is far greater. What is lost is more than just lives. It's an entire city. I think a peace that is won through words and advocated tirelessly will hold better than an alliance of bloodshed, even if it means at the price of more blood. Tears burned behind my eyes. How many people had I doomed?
Then your decision is made. Rip the thread.
I brought my hand slowly to the tapestry and wound my fingers around the red thread. It pulsed, struggling against me. I searched myself for the nerve to pull, but when I closed my eyes, all I saw were my people burning and bleeding. I drew my hand away, scalded. I can't.